Tonight on the Daily Debrief.
Gargiulo, who is athletic, stabbed her repeatedly in the left breast, arm, and chest.
A suspected serial killer of young women who moved from state to state, town to town, in order to evade capture, is now on trial. Plus, one Florida judge says secret cameras inside massage parlors can't be used at trial. How does that affect Robert Kraft's prostitution case? And the state's theory that a family of four was killed for money is put to the test. This is the Daily Debrief. It's Thursday, May 2nd. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Debrief. I'm Aaron Keller. Bob Hilla is here in studio with me. Judge Ashley Wilcott will be with me in just a moment. The trial of a suspected serial killer kicked off today in California. It's being called the case of the so-called Hollywood Ripper. Michael Gargiulo is accused of killing 22-year-old Ashley Ellerin in 2001 and 32-year-old Maria Bruno in 2005. He's also accused of attempting to kill Michelle Murphy in 2008. Ellerin was said to have been waiting for a date with actor Ashton Kutcher when she was stabbed to death in her Hollywood apartment. Let's go straight to the prosecution's opening statement.
The methodical and systematic slaughter of women by Michael Gargiulo, the boy next door killer. That's what this case is about. What you will hear is that Michael Gargiulo, for almost 15 years, was watching, always watching. And his hobby was plotting the perfect opportunity to attack women with a knife in and around their homes. What you will hear is that Trisha Picaccio, Ashley Ellerin, Michelle Murphy, and Maria Bruno were all young, attractive, and outgoing. What these women also had in common was they all lived near Gargiulo. He had targeted them for murder, and he ultimately attacked all of them with a knife.
The prosecutor says he has DNA and other evidence, and he started this argument by bringing in the Illinois case. Authorities think Gargiulo moved from Illinois to California to escape scrutiny back in Illinois, but they say this killing spree continued.
Within weeks of Gargiulo fixating on Ashley, entering her home without permission, surveilling her home at odd hours, flashing a knife, Ashley Ellerin was found stabbed to death in the hallway just outside her bathroom. Ashley had been stabbed over 47 times. The evidence will show that Gargiulo attacked Ashley from behind, cutting her throat from right to left, nearly decapitating her, and indicating an attack from a left-handed perpetrator. Gargiulo is left-handed. Ultimately, the evidence will show that the attack on Ashley Ellerin shared numerous common features with his attack on Trisha Picaccio and the subsequent attacks on Maria Bruno and Michelle Murphy.
We are still waiting for the defense to bring its case to this courtroom. The prosecution is still going. And by the way, the judge is only letting us record this case, opening statements, closing arguments, and verdict only. No witness testimony. We cannot bring you anything live. So, Attorney Bob Hilla and Judge Ashley Wilcott are here with me early tonight. So, Judge Wilcott, one victim was killed while waiting to meet up with a famous actor. Does that change the dynamic here at all, or is that just business as usual in Hollywood? People associate with actors and actresses.
Well, no, it changes the business, absolutely, because as you well know, now it was the focus of media at the time. So potentially it's touched everyone involved in the case in some way, whether they see that have this vague memory of, oh, yeah, media mentioned that that was his girlfriend, or whether they see it on social media currently. It absolutely ups the ante, so to speak, in terms of people paying attention to that versus the murder of the victim.
And Bob, how do attorneys defend this client when prosecutors pile on all these accusations together, all of these victims, one person? That changes the dynamic as well.
And what's interesting with this defendant is we haven't heard what their attack is going to be in this case. And it's going to be interesting to see in the opening statement of defense what they plan to put on or attack in terms of the prosecutor's very detailed case.
Certainly. Of course, you know, when you pile all these other bad acts in, it makes it a lot easier to get a conviction, and you have to have a legal nexus between all the cases to be able to do that. And here, they apparently won the chance to do that. It's a big win for the prosecution. It certainly changes things. Bob, Ashley, we'll be back to you as we roll along here tonight, because a Florida judge is deciding now whether authorities there broke the law when they installed cameras inside a massage parlor as part of a prostitution investigation, which netted the arrest of an NFL owner. Detectives say the recordings show New England Patriots owner Robert Kraft and others receiving illicit sexual massages. Kraft has pleaded not guilty to charges that he solicited prostitution, and his attorneys are arguing that the recordings were unconstitutionally gathered and must therefore be thrown out of court, even though the detectives had a warrant. The Kraft decision may be influenced by a different but similar case in another Florida county. In that case, a judge did suppress similar undercover massage parlor recordings, and it happened just yesterday. The judge there ruled that there was no Florida law on point, but that federal law required the police to minimize their invasion of privacy when installing cameras in private massage rooms. Instead, the police in this other case recorded multiple cameras in multiple rooms for between 2 and 4 weeks. The judge said the blanket storing of all surveillance of all rooms at all times was illegal. And finally, the original warrant in this other case authorized monitoring, not recording. And though the judge suggested police might have been insidious in their failure to understand the difference, he did not factor the distinction into his ruling. That decision in that other case may possibly influence the Kraft case, and Kraft's attorneys were certain to argue that his case contains the same flaws.
The warrant itself has no minimization instructions in it. It simply says don't look for non-sexual activity. We heard from witnesses today that there was no written requirements, there was no oral requirements. We heard from the second witness that she heard about minimization from her husband. She'd never minimized before. She had no instructions on how to minimize. The prior witness said, you know, no one told me what to do. I just sort of made my own decisions as I went. We saw as we went through the evidence on what they actually saw, that they were making their own decisions about what to look at and what not to look at. Judge, regardless of whether or not that is, you know, they were trying to, I think they said, which I have no reason to dispute, they were trying to maintain the dignity and respect and concern for the dignity and respect of these people. The fact is, that's not what the Constitution requires in any part of this country, under Florida law, U.S. Supreme Court law, and of any state. The requirement is that the instructions on minimization have to be put in the affidavit and or the warrant. It has to be very clear and set out and explain what it is you do to prevent innocent people or innocent conduct from being captured on this very intrusive method of investigation.
The prosecution told the judge there was a big difference between the Kraft case and this case from the other county where the prosecution lost. The other county's recordings went on for as much as 4 weeks, as we said. The recordings in the Kraft case lasted 4.5 days.
You need to know, Judge, that judge, first of all, how long was their recording?
30 days.
Their recording was for 30 days, and without making a comment on that, for whatever it's worth to the judge, forever weight you give a judge. We were 4.5 days?
Correct.
We were 4.5 days, Judge. And actually, to be honest with you, we were called, and I'm not blaming Jupiter, because officers want as much evidence as they can get. They called us on the phone. They told us what we had. We said, shut it down. Because 4.5 days was plenty. We had the evidence. We identified everybody in there. But for the defense to stand up here and talk about the Martin County case and not tell Your Honor that one of the main reasons why that was suppressed is because it was fettered recording of innocent people. And I think they had somewhere 25 or 30 different people with legitimate massage. Unfettered, Judge. Just recorded. Just carte blanche. Was the defense ever able to prove that there was no meeting? It's their burden that there was no meeting about that. No, they didn't prove that. All they proved is the two detectives that I called to the stand, and admittedly so, were not instructed.
One witness who raised eyebrows the other day during this hearing was the officer who was told to stop Kraft after Kraft left the massage parlor. That officer said Kraft rolled through a stop sign, and that's the excuse the officer needed to make the stop. The traffic stop was an excuse to identify the men, like Kraft, who left the spa. It's a bizarre setup. Watch this exchange.
There's probable cause to stop the car, and then for whatever reason, we were obtaining secondary probable cause to stop cars for traffic violations.
We'll get back to that.
Okay.
You know what? Let's not get back to that. Are you aware that other officers in your department believed on the day in question that they needed independent probable cause to stop the vehicles, not just probable cause based on the video?
Objection to what other officers believed, Your Honor.
Sustained.
Has any of the other officers told you that they understood that the directive was we needed independent probable cause to pull over the vehicle? We could not just do it based on what was radioed regarding the video.
No, sir.
This is really nitty-gritty, but the whole case turns on whether they can get this video into court. Now back to our panel, Judge Ashley Wilcott, Attorney Bob Hilla. So, Bob, the issue that the judge in the other case had was this unfettered recording. The fatal issue that may occur for the state in the Kraft case is whether or not an unfettered recording could have caught innocent victims in just 4.5 days.
Well, I think that's the essence of the issue here, does that issue go away if it's 30 days, 4.5 days? The real issue is that if it's too broad in scope, because it's going to catch people doing something that's not part of the investigation, and that the minimization requirement to the scope of the warrant is not comporting with law, then you can throw it out. It doesn't matter whether it's 4.5 days or 30 days.
Exclusionary rule. If this gets thrown out, this case sinks fast, and it's not coming back to the surface again. Judge Wilcott, a lot of stuff to talk about here. The other day I said, you know, I think this warrant's okay because they had enough information to seek it. You know, the execution is another issue, though, and that's where we're stuck right now. Is it going to be an issue that the judge in this other case threw it out using law from different federal circuits? Florida's in the 11th. He used law from the 9th and 10th to throw it out. Is that good law to just start importing this in without it having being mandatory authority?
Well, it's not mandatory authority, but certainly he can rely on that law so long as he's matched the facts before him to his applying of that law, and it could be the first time that this law is going to become law in Florida. I know that sounded like a whole bunch of words, but Aaron, here's my point. I loved your graphic, and it shows why that judge had a sound legal and factual basis, in my opinion, to order it suppressed in the other county.
Judge Wilcott, real quick, would you have thrown this out?
Yes, I think it's overbroad. I think that it could have been narrowed, and I think too many individuals' rights to privacy have been violated in 4.5 days of videoing.
Wow, that's going to be a huge loss for the state. We're going to move along, though, because coming up tonight on Brian Ross Investigates, it's going to be a great show. Chief Investigative Correspondent Brian Ross himself is joining us from the newsroom with a look at what he is working on. Brian, good to see you.
Aaron, good to see you. Well, tonight, the $100 million whistleblower, Bradley Birkenfeld, was paid this huge sum, actually $104 million, by the U.S. government for blowing the whistle on thousands of Americans who had secret, illegal bank accounts in Switzerland. They all got in trouble, had to pay back taxes, and now Birkenfeld tells us two things. One, there are more names he wants to reveal, and two, he wants a pardon from President Trump. Aaron?
Money and secrets tonight on Brian Ross Investigates. I'm not going to want to miss this one. I'll be watching. Brian, I'll see you in a little bit. And still ahead tonight here on The Debrief, an expert breaks down the odds as to whether convicted stepdaughter killer Tiffany Moss is likely to win an appeal as she sits on death row. Plus, the state says a California man killed a family of four for money. We're tracking the state's claims about motive and whether they make sense. That's when we head back to the courtroom after the break. The Georgia woman convicted of murder and sentenced to death for killing her stepdaughter is hoping an appeals court saves her life. Tiffany Moss is reportedly accepting the help of her standby attorneys in filing an appeal. The state Supreme Court in Georgia must at least review her case due to state law. Law professor Michael Mears, who has defended more than 100 death penalty cases in Georgia, tells the Law and Crime Network that Moss's chances of actually winning that appeal are slim.
Quite frankly, I'm opposed to the death penalty, but I don't see anything here that would cause the Board of Pardons and Paroles to grant her relief. Her only hope is going to be if the Georgia Supreme Court steps in and grants relief by vacating her sentence of death and demanding a new trial. Again, I don't see that happening either, because the district attorney that tried this case, Mr. Porter, did a very thorough job in making sure that her rights were made known to her and that she was afforded every opportunity. Matter of fact, this case went to the Georgia Supreme Court just before the trial started on the issue of whether or not she was competent to represent herself. Georgia Supreme Court says she was. So that takes away a big issue right there. I think that Ms. Moss was trying to get this jury to sentence her to death. She asked no questions. She did not present any evidence. She made no effort whatsoever to sway this jury in any way. It's called suicide by jury.
And now to the McStay family murders in California. Defendant Charles Merritt is accused of killing business associate Joseph McStay and the entire McStay family. The family all disappeared in 2010. 3 years later, the graves of all four of the McStays turned up in the desert. The defense is trying to convince the jury that another business associate named Dan Kavanaugh is behind the murders. The defense presented evidence that Kavanaugh may have been lying about his whereabouts when the family disappeared. Let's go way back to the beginning of this case when the prosecution said the motive for the killing was money.
How does this family of four disappear off the face of the earth? How does this family of four, a husband who's running a business, a mom who's raising her two kids, fixing up a house they just bought recently, how do they just disappear? Ladies and gentlemen, the evidence in this case will show you not only the how, but the why, and especially the who. The why boils down to a basic human emotion, something that we discussed during jury selection. The why boils down to greed. The why boils down to greed, and greed's child, fraud.
Here is the big problem. A forensic accountant testified that his stress test of the defendant's finances showed no clear gains after the death of the McStays.
As far as Mr. Merritt is concerned, you did review his records as well, correct?
That's correct.
In terms of after the disappearance of Mr. McStay, did you have an opinion as to whether Mr. Merritt either gained or lost from that disappearance financially?
My opinion was that he completed the jobs that were underway.
Objection calls for speculation and misstates evidence.
Overruled it. He understood that it's his opinion.
Go ahead, sir.
So the jobs that we had visibility to were completed to the best of our knowledge. We found no evidence of any claims for unfinished work. Payments were made in full on those jobs. The gain would have come just through the normal completion of the jobs rather than anything extraordinary.
So, did you have an opinion as to whether he gained or did not gain from the disappearance of Mr. McStay financially?
So as I stated before, we were looking for things that were outside the ordinary scope of business. We didn't find any gains outside the ordinary scope of business.
The cynics among us might say, well, maybe the gain wasn't that big. Maybe it didn't show up in the audit. Maybe the family of four died for just a little tiny bit of money that didn't even make a blip on the defendant's finances. That would be an unspeakable crime. A man beat a family of four to death with a hammer for barely any reward. But here's the thing, it doesn't make sense, because defendant Charles Merritt did business with victim Joseph McStay. And a lot of observers are saying Joseph was worth way more to this defendant alive as a business partner than he was dead. And the state still hasn't explained the three unknown DNA samples on items used to tie up the McStay family in their graves. The defense found those samples. I'm waiting to see how the state reacts to them. Also, what about these spots on a table found inside the McStay family home? The authorities testified that they missed the spots when they were searching in person and only discovered them when reviewing these photos of the crime scene. The prosecution wants the jury to give investigators a pass to assume this is blood with no testing to back up that assumption. A defense witness said he tried to recreate the state's theory but couldn't prove that blood would land that way on the table. So now, back to Judge Ashley Wilcott, Attorney Bob Hilly. Ashley, so, the state says the motive was money. I played the theory together with the defense forensic accountant. Shouldn't there be more actual evidence of a windfall if this was really about money?
I think so. And remember, motive is not an element of the crime, but of course a jury would like to know why would he possibly have done this. But listen, that's a very small to no motive in my mind, especially once you hear that defense witness. Now, how is the jury going to weigh that witness? Are they going to find him credible and believable and that it wasn't enough motive? We'll have to wait and see. But I think it really helps the prosecution's case.
Bob, what's your assessment of this? Do we have reasonable doubt here? We've got the DNA. We've got the unknown about the blood. We just have unknown, unknown, unknown. And for every state theory, the defense has put somebody up there to say, wait a minute, it likely didn't happen that way.
Well, I think, number one, you're correct on that. The comment you made about he's worth more alive than dead to the defendant, I think is something the jury's going to look at here and they can accept. The other issue is that you have another individual that could be in play just as much as a defendant. So it's going to be a tough case, I think, for the prosecution.
Yeah, I'm waiting to see where the prosecution goes with it. We are watching it very closely. Ashley, Bob, appreciate your insight tonight on The Debrief. And for those of you watching along, thanks for joining us. You can join us again tomorrow at 5 Eastern right here on The Debrief. Our live trial coverage picks up, though, tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock Eastern. Have a good night. We'll see you then, everybody. We'll be right back.